last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Let's go back to the continuing horrors of Gaza and significant potential new developments involving Israel just taking full occupation of Gaza. We have two guests with us. We'll get to the legality of all of that in a moment with Aoife O'Donoghue, Professor of Law at Queen's University. But first, Bel True, who's Chief International Correspondent of The Independent. Even before we talk about that potential, I know you have actually seen firsthand the horrors of what's happened to Gaza. Can you explain what it is you've actually seen?
So I've been on Jordanian military planes dropping aid on Gaza, which has, you know, basically been a kind of last desperate resort if Israel has maintained a blockade on aid into the strip. And looking down from the sky, it takes your breath away. I've spent a lot of time in Gaza. I was in Gaza in the 2012 war, in the 2014 war, in 2021. But I have never seen destruction of this kind. I've also spent time in other war zones like Mosul in Iraq. It looks like the bottom of a fire pit. It's just ash and destruction for kilometres. As we were going through the centre part of Gaza today, I spent 2 days on these planes. We also went over the Al-Mawasi so-called humanitarian zone, where basically hundreds of thousands of people have been corralled into a tiny spot that was basically empty beach land before the war, as they've been forcibly displaced from their homes from the bombardment and also evacuation orders. And in that area, you could just see tents to the horizon, just tents and tents and tents and tents and tents everywhere, families living basically in the elements. And this so-called humanitarian zone, I call so-called because it has come under Israeli bombardment as well. But the juxtaposition of those two images, the utter destruction, just ash and dust, and then an entire, you know, area covered in tents, was just chilling to see, and an example of what civilians on the ground in Gaza are dealing with every day.
And I noticed from the piece that you wrote along with one of your colleagues who was on the ground contributing as well, I mean, one of the bitter ironies is that the people who are starving in Gaza, who have risked their lives and have often many thousands, have a thousand at least, have been shot and killed by Israeli forces as they've tried to get food, that they also are at the risk of being killed by the pallets being dropped from the aircraft in which you were.
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't from the plane that I was on, but another plane earlier in that day, yesterday, dropped aid on Gaza, and one of them landed and killed a nurse called O'Day. And we spoke to his cousin at O'Day's funeral, who said that he'd been waiting in the punishing sun for 4 hours for aid that he knew might come from the sky, along with thousands of others, and he couldn't get out of the way in the scrum as the pallet landed on him. These pallets are like as much as a ton each. Last year, 5 people were killed when reportedly a parachute didn't deploy and it crashed through someone's a tent, killing a family. So, you know, the point about this is that it can be very dangerous. It's also expensive. One UN official was telling me it's about 100 times more expensive to send a C-130 military plane over Gaza and drop some aid than it is send the equivalent via truck. And it's also not getting to those in need. Those who are severely malnourished are not able to get to these sites. It's a scrum of the survival of the fittest. Some of the aid is landing in the sea. I was talking to one father who said he can't swim and he couldn't get the aid. And when someone did bring it back by boat, it was sodden by salt water. So it's usually a last resort for when you cannot access an area. And we should be reminded that Gaza is 25 miles long. It's a few miles wide. It is completely accessible by land and by sea. The only way to properly deal with this crisis is to have a full ceasefire and get aid in through the land crossings on an unprecedented level to stop more people from dying.
Of course, we've also had the outrage now in recent days at the site of the Israeli hostages starving in Gaza, and clearly Hamas should never have taken those hostages. Hamas should have released those people. We hope that they would. But yet in Israel, is there a realization that these people are starving because so many other people in Gaza are starving? It's not a deliberate policy from the part of Hamas or others. It's just that they don't have the food.
So from the Israeli side, at least from the largest group representing the families of the hostages, they have firmly blamed Hamas for starving the hostages who were underground. And we should be clear here, they took over 250 people into Gaza, including babies. The images that came out of the emaciated two hostages, you know, included one man who said he was told to dig his own grave. The conditions they're being held in are appalling. So from the Israeli side, they have blamed Hamas. But of course, there are also deep concerns, because if there is no food in Gaza, then that means that the hostages and the captives are also not getting food. Whether or not Hamas has deliberately additionally starved the people they're holding, we don't know. But for sure, if people in Gaza are starving, then the hostages and captives will also be in that condition. And there's also deep concern that Israel's bombardment could endanger their lives as well. And so that is why the families of the hostages, the largest group representing them, have been in the streets every single day for nearly 22 months, calling their Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to agree to a ceasefire on any terms and bring their loved ones home. I've spoken to the families on numerous occasions, and they have said to me again and again, every second that their loved ones are in Gaza is a threat to their lives. They need this war to be over, for their loved ones to come home, and for them to then start the process of rebuilding their lives.
But has Benjamin Netanyahu any real interest in a ceasefire? Whatever talks he might have with the US Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff, whatever might be said, is it the case that in reality he is now about to complete what was the goal all along, which is the complete invasion of and takeover of Gaza?
What we know at the moment is coming out of leaked reports to Israeli media, where Netanyahu is apparently weighing a permanent or semi-permanent military occupation of Gaza and an expansion of the existing offensive. But he's receiving some pressure back in Israel from that. On one hand, he has the extreme right members of his cabinet who have said appalling things publicly, including that Gaza should effectively be flattened and destroyed and that the Palestinians should leave Gaza. That's, you know, the finance minister, for example, is one who said those comments. But on the other hand, Netanyahu is facing pressure from within his own security establishments. We had an extraordinary open letter penned to Donald Trump this week by 600 former security and military officials, saying that they didn't believe that Hamas, you know, posed that much of a threat to Israel and that the war had to end. I've been receiving reports that there's a lot of disgruntlement within the military who've said enough is enough. There's a lot of pressure coming from within the, you know, Israeli population because of reservists who are being called up. People are apparently, I heard even rumours that people were trying to break their own legs to avoid call up. I mean, I can't independently verify that, but that's certainly the chatter on the ground in Israel. And we've had, you know, apparently disagreements between Netanyahu and his army chief as well on how to proceed, with the army chief apparently, you know, opposing, you know, continuing this conflict, you know, internally, and having troops in Gaza for a permanent basis as well.
But what's left in Gaza as it stands? I mean, you know, isn't it a situation is that if he takes it off, what's left there? For those right-wing elements in his government who are saying that it should be flattened, isn't it effectively flattened almost already?
Well, according to the United Nations, 92% of housing units in Gaza, so that's homes, have been destroyed or damaged. And around 70% of the total amount of the housing units have been destroyed or damaged. And you can see that from the sky. You can just see ashen mess below. There was one estimate, I think it was last year, that the destruction is so widespread it could take 21 years to rebuild Gaza if the war stops right now. So certainly the project of taking on this blasted, war-ravished patch of land would be huge to rebuild it and to, you know, try and bring back any semblance of life. And of course, most importantly, there are over 2 million Palestinians who are corralled into different parts of this devastated area. And they have a right to a life and a home, and to go back to their own homes that have been destroyed. So, you know, the biggest issue here is the day after. If there is a ceasefire, what happens? And if you look at the extreme right members of Netanyahu's government, they are endorsing war crimes and possibly ethnic cleansing. And that's coming from legal experts I've spoken to. If you're talking about forcible transfer of people from their homes, if you're talking about permanent military occupation, if you're talking about seizing land, you know, this is massive violations of international law. And so, you know, really, I don't know if, even if that was the goal for Netanyahu and extreme right members of his cabinet, whether that would even be permitted by his allies, because we're certainly seeing pressure coming from the US, who, of course, supplies him the most weapons out of all countries in the world, and the UK, which is also a weapon supplier to Israel, saying, you know, enough's enough, this needs to be sorted, there needs to be a long-lasting peace.
Bel True, Chief International Correspondent of The Independent, thank you. Aoife O'Donoghue, as a Professor of Law with an expertise in international law at Queen's University, genocide, war crimes, these type of terms we hear very, very rarely, but based on the evidence that the likes of Bel has been able to provide for us and many other journalists over the last couple of years, is it fair to say that, what we're seeing is genocide? It is war crimes happening in front of our eyes.
Yes, I think the evidence at this point is pretty unequivocal. I mean, we're still waiting for the International Court of Justice to come to its decision. But even since they had their hearings, things have gotten so much worse. And things were bad then, but things have gotten so much worse. And obviously, it's very difficult for journalists to get in, foreign journalists aren't allowed. But from the information that can be seen from air and from the information that is coming out of Gaza, but also what's being explicitly said by the Israeli government, we are at a point where I don't think it can really realistically be denied. I mean, forcibly moving people, absolutely, but also starvation, forcibly, you know, not allowing food to get in, allowing a population to starve is a form of genocide. It is widely recognised and is indisputable. So I think we are absolutely there.
And then, what about this idea that Netanyahu seems to have that has just taken complete control of Gaza?
Well, Israel has illegally occupied both the West Bank and Gaza since 1967. So they said that they've fully withdrawn. But as we can see, as what's happening now, they are actually in control of the territory in that they can close it off to food, they can close it off to journalists, they can stop people leaving. So while they weren't running it day to day, while Hamas was in charge, they still had control over Gaza as they have in the West Bank. And as recent as 2024, there was an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice, once again reiterating that. And we've had previous judgments as well, for instance, about the wall, when the wall went up between Israel and the West Bank through occupied West Bank. But they have actually been in illegal occupation now since 1967, and the full annexation would just, in lots of ways, just be kind of a confirmation of what actually has been happening, but in a way that would prevent any form of return. I mean, that has been the story for Palestinians. Every time they're forced to leave, they're told they're allowed to go back. They are never allowed to go back. And that this would just be one more iteration of that has been going on now since the end of World War II for the people of Palestine.
Does the international legal system actually work? Because, you know, we can quote the International Court of Justice and various findings, but essentially none of this has stopped the Israelis doing as they want, has it?
Well, I think as with any legal order, you also need the political will to enforce it. I mean, you even need that in domestic law. The politicians domestically weren't interested in enforcing the law, and you can see that in some countries in the world. And then it stops being, and there isn't, I mean, it is true that at the moment the United States is starting to put a bit more pressure. The UK is starting to put more pressure. It's very good that, for instance, France has announced that it will recognise Palestine, but it needs the other players to actually enforce it. So even if the ICJ come out and confirm that genocide is happening, it does require then the US and the United Kingdom and other countries to stop supplying them with arms, to stop aiding it, to stop carrying out, supporting them, and it requires, so it not only requires the sort of the law itself to operate, but also for the other actors in international, principally the states, the other countries, to then abide by those findings. So abiding by the finding that there has been an illegal occupation since 1967, that is supposed to end, and it really requires all those other countries to also follow the law. And to recognise that the rule of law and international law is important for all our safety on any matter, not just this, but for the whole order to work. But at the moment, that is frankly not working. And it absolutely needs the United States to be firmly behind it. And they obviously aren't interested. And because of Ukraine, Russia isn't interested either. So we're stuck in a situation where none of the players that really can enforce it are interested at all.
Aoife O'Donoghue, Professor of Law, Queen's University. Thank you.
The Last Word on Today FM.